Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Dr. Amy Parekh, Chief Medical Officer at Grand Rounds. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing very well. It's great to have you on the show today. Kind of before we dive into the main part of our conversation, would you be able to give everyone a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So I'm Amy Parekh. I'm an internist, so I have trained to see adult patients primarily, and I'm Grand Rounds' first chief medical officer. I started here about 2.5 months ago. I came from UCSF, where I was the chief medical officer for population health and clinical integration. And before that, I worked at places like McKinsey & Company and other places and have been dedicated to trying to solve healthcare's biggest problems. My background before that is I went to medical school and law school at Yale.
So you're both a doctor and a lawyer.
You know, I never took the bar, so I don't think I'm allowed to call myself a lawyer officially, but I did go to law school and graduate.
It's a very interesting choice to for a dual degree. So kind of what brought you into healthcare in the first place? You know, guessing that there must have been something if you had done medical school.
Yeah. So honestly, when I was not one of those children. If you had asked me when I was five, I would have said I'm going to be a doctor. A lot of my colleagues who are doctors today did come from that path, and I really respect them for that. When I went to college, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I really always had a passion for science, and I loved the process of discovery and using evidence to come to conclusions. But while I was in college is when I really discovered a passion for society. And I took political science classes and learned that I liked working with people and solving hard problems that science couldn't always answer. And I liked working directly with people. And so medicine became for me the way to meld my passion for science with my love of people. And that's why I started to pursue medical school. In med school, really it was my third year of medical school where I realized that I had made the right choice. During third year is when you actually start to get to see patients. And I started on medicine wards at Yale New Haven Hospital. And I just remember going home every day and telling my husband how happy I was that I had made the right choice. Because every time you interact with a patient, every time you make someone feel a little bit better, even if it's sometimes just through reassurance and sometimes it's through cure and by helping someone not suffer, that feeling is like no other in the world, and it was a privilege to be able to do it as a medical student, and I'm really glad that I still get to do it today as a doctor. So that's what drew me to healthcare, and that's what has kept me in. You might ask, why then don't I see patients all day, every day, for 40 hours a week? It's because at the same time that I was realizing how much I love being able to help individual patients, I was also realizing how broken the system itself was. And that's how the system wasn't set up in a way to help me as a doctor work to my highest capabilities and make sure that patients really got better. So many patients, I would try to help them when I saw them in the hospital, give them prescriptions, try and figure out what the right diagnosis was and treatment course, but then they didn't have the ability to adhere to that treatment plan. They couldn't afford their co-payments. They didn't even know how things worked in healthcare. Some of them lost their insurance. And it was those systems-based problems that attracted me to roles like I've had over the last 8 years to really fix that in addition to being able to help individual patients one-on-one.
You know, that's actually, you know, a very perceptive comment, and it's a very interesting timing. So my wife is also a physician, and we were having a very similar conversation recently where, you know, she was expressing a lot of frustration about how the system operates and that it doesn't align with being able to do the best that you can for your patients at times. So kind of as you were just saying, your recognition of that issue has led you into kind of a parallel, it seems like, administrative and clinical path. So from that administrative side, what are some of the efforts that you've undertaken to help improve the conditions around the problems that you are identifying on the clinical side?
Yeah. So my role at UCSF prior to coming here was in population health and clinical integration. And that those are sounds like a lot of jargon, because that's what we do in healthcare. We make things sound like jargon. But really what it was about is about changing how things in healthcare get paid for so that the incentives are aligned so that health systems and individual physicians can provide the best care possible for their patients. That does assume you believe that how you pay for something impacts what you get out of it. My role here at Grand Rounds, the reason I came to Grand Rounds was really to be able to scale some of the stuff I was able to do at UCSF in Northern California at the national level. So, you know, the things that we're doing at Grand Rounds is being able to partner directly with employers so that we can have aligned incentives and make what we now cover as 4.7 million lives better. We believe that actually by working directly with the employers who bear the cost of healthcare, we will have the incentives to get the right care to the right patient at the right time. And we want to do that for everyone everywhere as quickly as we can. So what I've tried to do, and this takes a lot of people trying to work this way to fix the healthcare system, is take what I've learned from law school and from McKinsey and from UCSF, and now here at Grand Rounds, bring that to apply it to a national level. And we do that through two products here. You know this. One is mostly around second opinions, making sure that people are getting the right diagnosis and the right treatment course. Because it takes about 17 years from evidence to go from our premier academic medical centers to the community here in the United States. And by shortening that and making sure that patients are getting better diagnosis and treatment as quickly as possible, we believe patients will get better care, and that will be done in a more cost-effective way over time. And then secondly, how do we just get patients to the right primary care and secondary care from the start so that they don't have to wait till they need a second opinion for a diagnosis? And that's what we've built with Summit, which is our second product, which is really about letting people start in healthcare in the best way possible. So I'm excited about this new role that I've taken on here at Grand Rounds, because I think we really are trying to get to how do we get the best clinical insights to the most people as fast as possible.
So when you're talking about getting clinical insights to individuals, do you think the individuals are always or necessarily aware of when they are getting the appropriate insights or maybe getting insights that don't have sufficient backing behind them?
That's a really great question. I think most patients don't really know because no one really knows what high quality care is. We're trying to define that better for people here at Grand Rounds. What we do know is that when a patient does ask for a second opinion because they just think something's not right, we change the diagnosis or the treatment of that patient 60% of the time, over 60% of the time. So we do know that some patients are pretty good, I think, at knowing when something's just not right. And so they come to us asking for a second opinion just when they have a feeling that something's not going right here. I'm not getting the most appropriate treatment. They don't know what the solution is, and they shouldn't have to. That's what the healthcare system should do for them. And so then they come to us, and we change the diagnosis or the treatment plan a majority of the time. And so that number has always shocked me. And I wish we lived in a world where that weren't the case, but we do see that.
You know, I agree. When you cited that 60% figure, I was very surprised. I would have expected a much lower number. And trying to maybe dig behind that a little bit, and do you have any data around, I guess, maybe the most prevalent causes for having to change the resulting diagnosis or having to change some piece of it?
So for the misdiagnosis as opposed to the change in treatment cases. So for misdiagnosis, you know, in medical school, we're trained to take in as much data as we can from patients in the way of signs or symptoms, and then we apply it to what our base of knowledge is from everything we've learned in physiology and pathology, and we form what we call a differential diagnosis. And when you're in medical school, your job is really to keep that, because you have the luxury of time, Your job is to keep that differential diagnosis as broad as possible, and that's what you kind of tell your attendings and teachers. As we become more experienced physicians, we start to shorten, because we need efficiency and we need to move quickly, we often shorten our list in our differential diagnosis. We use heuristics to get to places quicker, to get to the answer quicker. And I think sometimes we miss the zebras because we're so used to seeing the horses. And so how do we as physicians then rebroaden our differential when things aren't fitting into the puzzle is where the misdiagnosis comes in. So we've had a couple of cases at Grand Round. So one example is a patient who actually thought she had MS for a long time, and she didn't have MS. And that happens. It's also happened with cancer, where patients think they have one type of cancer, and actually, you know, we do a re-review of the pathology, and it's something different. And obviously, those things have huge implications for the treatment path. And then in addition to that, sometimes the diagnosis is correct, but the treating physician locally hasn't maybe read the most recent evidence-based treatment options for that diagnosis. And so we just bring that evidence closer to home so that they can see, oh, there's a brand new treatment out that came out in the medical literature very recently that our expert is able to provide insight on so that the patients can get the best treatment available for them in today's time. And that's how what we've seen in diagnosis and treatment. So the 60% is both diagnosis and treatment, just so you know. Right. They're not all diagnosis.
Right. And I think even, you know, thank you for helping to make sure that was very clear in terms of where the figure comes from. But I think even with the combination, it's still a much higher number than I would imagine most people would believe. And then kind of, I liked how you were describing where it's, you know, and having seen it from afar in terms of the, you know, when you're in medical school and residency, you're given a lot more freedom when it comes to time. And I know I'm speaking very much in relative terms, considering there's still only so much time to do things. But, you know, the pressures are different. And I think you're alluding to that, you know, once you're in practice, especially since so many practices are on a fee-for-service model still, where you need to churn through patients, to be frank about it. Otherwise, you're not going to be bringing in enough money. So when, like, kind of the second, when the request for a second opinion comes to you in your current, or through to the company and it's in its position, do you feel that some of the benefit is that you're not constrained by maybe the same parameters that the treating providers are, or do you have maybe a more specialized network of clinicians that are working with you guys who maybe are, because they're doing this type of thing, see those zebras more often?
Yes and yes. So you're really insightful. And so we, our physicians, our staff physicians here, do not have the pressure on time. Their initial call to the patient, which often happens very quickly after the patient has asked for a second opinion, can usually last almost 30 minutes. And that's not even including an exam. That's just a conversation, right, between the patient and a doctor to really understand what the symptoms are, what the patient has already gone through to try to diagnose or treat their issue, and ensures that the questions we're then asking the expert are the right questions to be asking. So I think you're right on in that our physicians don't have that same incentive structure that most practicing physicians do. And then the second piece that you said is we do have a wide network of thousands of experts across the country who help us ensure that we're using the most evidence-based treatments. And so we have curated that network to make sure that we're asking the right people the right questions. So it's also not just having a bunch of cardiologists, for example. It's making sure that if a patient's struggling with heart failure, they're getting insight from the premier heart failure physician in the country. Or if a patient has CAD, they're getting the best insight on that. Or if it's an arrhythmia problem, they're getting insight from an electrophysiologist. So it's going that next level deeper. And that's what our physicians at Grand Rounds help figure out. What is the right specialty to answer this patient's question? Because sometimes that's actually often the issue. People don't really know what specialty to go to. We've become so specialized.
You know, that is a very interesting point. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Dr. Amy Parekh from Grand Rounds. We've been talking misdiagnosis and second opinions, and I think some of the broader kind of underlying issues within healthcare that reveals. And as we've been talking a bit about the second opinions piece right now, I'm actually realizing maybe we should take a step back and more clearly define what we actually mean by a second opinion.
That's great. And actually, we often call what we do actually expert opinions as opposed to second opinion. So we should talk about that. So in my mind, a second opinion might be with another physician of the same expertise level that the first physician made a diagnosis or treatment plan of. And it's still a great idea to get a second opinion whenever you're faced with a big diagnosis that's going to cause you or anyone in your family suffering and, you know, a medical problem. But what we think of is what we provide is actually an expert opinion, which is it's not necessarily an internist asking another internist for their opinion on a matter. It is truly going to that next level of expertise. So sometimes that means a subspecialist. Sometimes that means there's only a few of these doctors in the country that know the evidence behind a certain very specific diagnosis, and it means getting their opinion on something. So at Grand Rounds, what we do say is that we give expert opinions. So that's how we've looked at it so far.
No, and I think that's actually a very good framing for it, because, you know, as you're suggesting, it sometimes you've got issues where you've got subspecialties within specialties and kind of getting further and further down a chain. And depending on where you're located, you might not be able to find the right clinician with the right experience, but, you know, the people who are available to you can get you part of the way there. And then, as you said, you need to get someone with the actual more focused knowledge who mm-hmm. can, who have seen the, you know, a rarer instance of something and can be able to pinpoint it more exactly.
Yeah. When I first came here from UCSF and I had done my training at the Brigham in Boston, I really felt like this was one way to democratize access across the country to places that I had been privileged to be able to practice at. Coming from the academic medical center space, I saw the power of having the right specialist there at the right time. And I do know that that kind of access is not available across this country in rural areas, you know, where all of Americans live and work. And so one of the things we want to do is to be able to just open up the doors so that no matter where you live, you can have that same kind of access to that kind of specialty.
And when you're seeking that additional access, and I think I'm going to start using this phrasing, but when you're seeking that additional expert opinion, what type of information is the most useful for a patient to gather and present if the patient is initiating it, and then I guess we'll answer that one first, and then we'll kind of go to the next piece, which is if the clinician is the one who wants the expert opinion, are there differences in terms of how the information would get presented?
Yes. So first of all, if you are the patient, I think just remembering that there are no stupid questions. There is nothing that you should be assumed to know before you begin your expert opinion or before you begin your interaction with the healthcare community. It's really scary when you get sick. And our job as a healthcare community should never be to scare you more. It should be to reassure you, and you should feel comfortable asking whatever questions are on your mind. So that's step one. Don't show up afraid to ask a question. Step two is, if you have the time and can be thoughtful before you are able to approach a physician to get an expert opinion, thinking through the actual time course of your symptoms and trying to be objective about what your symptoms were and when they started. So really sort of, for example, saying, about a month ago, I developed a headache. It started in the back of my head and it was throbbing, not stabbing. 2 weeks ago, the headache actually went away completely, but then returned 5 days after that. And when it returned, my vision was also blurry. So specific timelines and specific symptoms are really helpful. And that is something that only the patient knows. And that is where the patient is expert, and we bring our insight to it. So that is probably the most important part. The second thing is, if you as a patient have already seen a physician or have already had imaging done or labs done with the hopes that those would have elucidated more about the problem itself, share that openly and willingly. So tell the expert, I've already gotten imaging, like a CT scan or an MRI or an X-ray, at this, or this hospital. I've already seen a neurologist and a cardiologist for this issue, because it helps the expert understand what's already been done so that they don't repeat, they don't make requests to repeat stuff that's already been done before, and they can get you the answer you need faster. Those would be the two most important things, I think, for patients if they have the time to prepare to show up with, which is a very detailed list of what the symptoms and timings were, as well as what's already been done.
So do you find that when a patient is seeking the expert opinion, that they might share different information with the expert than they might have with the first set of physicians or clinicians that they're being treated by?
I don't know. You know, I think that's a really interesting question. We talk about this. So when I was an attending at where I practiced before, sometimes we would say, like, a patient sometimes would tell the resident one thing and then would tell the attending something different. And either it would be more expansive or less expansive, or a new symptom would emerge. And I don't think it's because the story has changed. I think it's just because as patients reflect on what's actually been happening over the course of what's often a longish period of time, different things make them remember things that they might not have otherwise. And what we do as doctors is, as we ask questions, the story actually refines itself over time. So I do think that if you ask a patient on day one, and it's one doctor asking them to recite their history of headaches, and then a different doctor asks them on day three to recite their story on headaches, it might be a little bit different. And that's okay, as long as we eventually get to a place whereas we can be as objective as possible so that we have the data to make the right diagnosis. I think getting closer and closer to what actually happened in what time frame is what leads to the best diagnosis.
No, and I certainly hope that that is kind of how it is. As you said, it's refining. And, you know, it's just you and I always end up going back to just experiences with family members or extended family members yeah. who would purposefully say, oh, I didn't tell the doctor that because they don't need to know that. And then, you know, I yeah. just remember my wife's grandfather would tell her that as she was going through training, and she would just, you know, do a face palm because it would be like, no, you need to tell the doctor that because it's going to impact the diagnosis.
Yeah. You know, at Grand Rounds, one of the things that we've said a lot, and I think this is really true, is our staff physicians, so the doctors who work for us, become your doctor in the family. So I think I am the only doctor in my immediate family. And because I went to law school, a lot of my friends are really smart but aren't doctors. And so I get asked many medical questions a lot of the times, and I often wonder, would they not ask this to their actual doctor? And one of the things we're trying to do at Grand Rounds is open up that door a little bit so that the person you're talking to first, before it goes to the expert, is one of our staff physicians. And you should feel comfortable asking them whatever it is you would ask the family member that is a doctor. Because the more we can break down that barrier, the better care we'll all be able to deliver. So I think you're right on that perception that patients don't tell doctors things that they probably should be. And I don't know if it's because of fear or because they don't want to appear like they don't know something, but there is no expectation. If you're the patient, you're the patient. We're here to help you. So you should tell us everything so that we can help you better.
Yeah, and to some degree, I wonder if it goes to a culture of how the physicians, or the culture of the work environment that the physicians are in. If, as you're saying, where you are now, it's we want your staff physicians to be viewed as that family member physician, it probably influences how questions are presented to patients or individuals. And I think how you phrase a question and what tone you use with the question will have a very big impact in terms of the response that you get to it.
Yes, we are. Our goal is to ask open-ended questions. And I think you interview people for podcasts. We interview people so we can make the right diagnosis. But the approach is very similar, which is the more open-ended questions you get, you usually get the answers quicker and they're more thorough and there's more information in them.
Yeah. So as we're, believe it or not, already winding down towards the end of our time today, I'm going to ask you a very interesting I think a unique final question, and it's one that I've almost been holding on to since you said that you went to medical school and law school. And the question is, I think both of those schools train people to think in extremely different ways and to try and attack problems in different ways. But at the end of the day, kind of it goes back to what you're saying, what you had said very much towards the beginning, which is, you wanted to be a problem solver, and I think both medical school and law school train you to try and identify and then work your way through a problem. So how do you view the two lines of training that you receive from those two types of backgrounds, and then how have they tempered each other?
So they're very complementary. I like to have a plan A and a plan B and a plan C for every problem I try to solve. And so sometimes I will use a systems-based approach, which is for medical school, to solve a problem. But then I'll check it, right, from the legal approach. And so what I learned in med school, honestly, was that in order to be a great clinician and to solve the nation's problems around healthcare in the most effective way, I was going to have to combine competence, which is what you get in med school, from a clinical perspective, with kindness, which is what you only learn when you see patients over and over and over again. And it's that combination that I think you get in med school. In law school, I think I really understood the importance of detail in a way that, yes, I learned in med school, but man, lawyers are the most detail-oriented people I have ever met. And an attention to detail and a systematic way of knowing what the external world is placing on a problem, so that you can attack each of those one by one by one by one. It's like, you know, when you lay out a case, it's like argument one, argument two, argument three, and they all defend the same position. That thoroughness is what you get from law school as well. And so I think the two approaches are really complementary, and I hope that by having different ways to solve problems, the solutions we'll come up with will be more sustainable and will last long. And I mean, another word for sustainable is will last longer and help more people.
Yeah, no, very, very interesting response. And you know, as I had mentioned, we are out of time already. So I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Amy Preck, for a great conversation today.
Thank you, Matt, for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.